Good morning, and welcome to the CSP Radio Show, presented by Crawford Stewardship Project. I am your host and CSP Agriculture Coordinator, Joseph Childs. Today, we are going to explore the topic of monopolies within the food industry and how the growing number of agricultural business monopolies affects all of us, both producers and consumers, in the small towns that we know and love. To help us explore this topic, I've invited Austin Frerich, author of the book Barrens, in which he covers this very topic in great detail and dives headfirst into the issue of concentration in the food supply chain. Austin was a keynote speaker at Wisconsin Farmers Union Convention last month and caught my attention when speaking about just how widespread the effects of monopolies are and the policies that are in place that make it possible for them to exist. Welcome, Austin. So glad that you could join us today. And first things first, I'd just like you to give a little bit of a background on your book, Barrens, and what readers can expect from it.
Yeah, so my book profiles seven different robber barons in the food system. And part of it is I'm using that robber baron as like a narrative device to tell bigger structural stories. So like, you know, I have a grain baron in my book, but that's really the story of the farm bill and changes in the farm bill over the last century. So that's kind of what I'm doing in my book, is telling you these different concepts in the food system and building on them. And at the same time too, I really wanted to use that robber baron framework to show people we've been here before. I think we're living in another gilded age, another laissez-faire moment, and to also show people that we know what to do here. We know how to overcome this concentrations of power that is corrupting the political system. So it's both kind of an entertaining way to tell these stories, but also to kind of, you know, really put this in like a historical context for folks.
It's a very interesting book. I've read about 3/4 of the way through it right now, and I've read quite a few other books along those lines. And in fact, did a radio interview here on WDRT about The Meat Racket by Christopher Leonard, and it dives into specifically the chicken and pork industry with Tyson. But you mentioned talking about the farm bill, and you know we've been here before. So can you tell me what mechanisms have allowed these barons to exist? What is put in place that makes this not only incentivized, but really it's kind of the only way to operate at the moment?
Yeah, well, let me first just start by saying I adore that book, Meat Racket, you mentioned. It's one of my favorite food books. I recommend it to anyone. Also, I should just say that author, Chris Leonard, is one of my favorite writers. To your question about robber barons and how they got here is, I think when I started this book, I had this notion of, oh, these are the, you know, most efficient, the biggest, most technological advance. But then when you start lifting up the hood and investigating each market, you realize, oh, these are just an old classic story of corporate capture. And I guess we shouldn't be shocked. I mean, never forget, let me step back for a second. The goal of any corporate executive is monopoly. That's where profits are. Because, you know, competitive markets are hard. It's ruthless. You wake up every day, how do I beat my opponent? Your goal is you want to corner a market so then you can kind of, you know, get a little cream off the top. And so, I mean, that's, to me, is like kind of the story of the American economy right now. It's just a lot of markets are concentrated. And I think I think the food industry in America is the most concentrated space in America. Because, you know, even when we talk about like slaughterhouses or milk, we use national figures, but you're not going to take, you know, Wisconsin milk and sell it in Seattle. You know, milk is local, it's regional. And once you start using regional numbers, these markets are even more concentrated. Like Pete Harding of Oregon, Wisconsin did a paper for me at a conference a few years ago where one company has an 85% market share in fluid milk in New England. And I don't need a PhD in econ to know those people are not paying a fair price for milk. So that's what I kind of do in each chapter, is kind of show which corners were cut in this like bigger race to the bottom. Because here's the thing, like the family farm doing pasture dairy can't compete on price against a dairy baron who's cutting corners and engaging in questionably legal things. And I think for me intellectually is I wanted to write this book to understand how those corners were cut, because you have to understand how the corners were cut in order to fix them. It's as simple as that.
Now, are these legal corners that are being cut? Are these loopholes that are left open that are being exploited? Or is this something that is illegal that these operations are doing?
I would argue all the above. I mean, I should also say writing this book is every commodity is different. And every production region in America is different. And I got to be very careful with my words here, just because, I mean, even consolidation, the book industry means the liability now is on me. So what kind of shocked a lot of people reading my book is I have nearly 1,000 citations, and that's because, you know, if I'm wrong, the barons can sue me. So I had to cross my T's, dot my I's. So I just want to be very careful with my words here. But it seemed, I would argue that there is some, you know, illegal things going on, but also just old-fashioned buying up politicians and corrupting the political system to reinforce current economic structures that benefit a few.
That's where I seem to think that a lot of this happens is it's shady but completely legal, and it's not like they went out looking for the loophole that already exists. It seems like they knew what they wanted and they got the right person involved and brought that policy forward themselves to create the loophole for themselves. Now, does that sound kind of how like the process works, or is this just kind of dumb luck, they stumble upon something?
No, I don't ever use the word dumb here. That is, it's a weird thing to say to write a book like this, but there is a level of business brilliance to a lot of these people. You got to respect that. But then there's also an unethicalness to them. Like take Sam Walton. So Walmart, my grocery baron, they sell 1 in 3 groceries in America. It is brilliant what the company built. At the same time, too, they really exploited certain legal loopholes. Like one example is a lot of the stores when they started off were their own legal entity, because back then you could essentially you didn't have to pay minimum wage if things were small. So, you know, they were paying wages half the minimum wage. You know, is that, you know, that's a, you know, you're exploiting a loophole in that case. So, you know, you can both admire and also fear some of the power of these people. That said, I kind of view this almost as a toolkit. So sure, there is, you get big, you write regulations to your benefit. The other two things I've noticed is what they tend to do is, you know, maybe you're doing something illegal, but then you use your economic power to corrupt the political system to then make that behavior legal. Or another common thing, and I see this more with my hog baron, is you just basically gut or like defund an agency so no one can kind of keep an eye on what you're doing. So who knows if what's going on there or not. I mean, that is like the big, there's a lot of unknowns here. It's kind of what I realized is just no one's keeping an eye on a lot of these markets. But, you know, the cops aren't on the beat.
Mm-hmm. So, it might be illegal, but there's no enforcement. So if there's no enforcement, is it really going to deter people? Now you're just relying on people's morals. And as we see time and time again, money creates looser morals with most businesses and entities. And I wanted to talk a little bit more. So we kind of got it narrowed down on what mechanisms are there that allow this to happen. So now that it's happening, who cares, right? Why should the average consumer or the average farmer care? What impact does it have on them? And why should they read your book? And why should they feel a little bit, irritated about this, that it's happening?
So for just like your average, I don't want to use the word consumer, but like your average American out there listening, to me, this impacts you directly two ways. One, it makes for bad tasting food. I think that's the underappreciated thing with the current system is, you know, like especially meat and dairy inputs matter. If you're drinking milk coming from cows on an industrial feedlot in the Mexico desert, that's just not going to make a good product. Whereas like a cow on pasture eating a rich grass diet is going to make such a better product. Even like my berry baron, you know, they became a baron because, you know, they grow berries now on every continent in the world except Antarctica. So some days your berries are coming from Argentina, sometimes it's Morocco. But here's the thing, that berry's not engineered for taste, it's engineered for durability. So that's one thing, it's just a kind of collapse in taste, why a lot of food's kind of anymore. And the second thing is what you're paying. I mean, you're being gouged. It's a little aggressive to say, but we're paying more for junk. Dollar for dollar, Americans spend more money on food than people in Germany, Canada, United Kingdom. And we're about dollar for dollar even with Italy. And trust me, anyone that's been to Italy knows what a dollar gets you there is so much better than here.
I just returned from Rome, and I can honestly say every single meal that I had there was like life-changing almost. I had a pepperoni pizza that shifted how I looked at pizza for the rest of my life. And it was just a small restaurant. It wasn't expensive. It was, the food there is a lot cheaper, and it's just, frankly, a lot better.
And that's like what, just on a personal note, so my husband and I actually did our honeymoon in Italy because I wanted to see a food system that worked. And we had the same reaction where like, you're having an incredible meal that you're spending $30 on, for two people, maybe 40, including wine. And you kind of see what the system could be. And you also just realize, I mean, you realize how far off our system's gotten. And like that, if there's a silver lining I have writing this book is, I've gotten a lot of positive press from the business world, like Bloomberg especially, because a lot of upper-class Americans that go abroad, they just see the food's better, cheaper, and healthier for you abroad. Like, our country's just not making good food. And that, to me, is a ray of hope, is everyone's kind of seeing the system not work. And, like, you know, what the system means for farmers is, first of all, most farmers cannot compete on price against these people cutting corners. And so a lot of them are going bankrupt. And at the same time, or the ones left standing, is they're both being squeezed on the input side from consolidation, but also on the output side, because they have less people paying for their product. And so you're, to me, the bigger story here is not just farmers, but it's rural America is producing the most it's ever produced, but none of their wealth is staying there. You know, you're just seeing this being extracted because they don't have the power. And I think the best stat that captures it is USDA has published for nearly a century the stat where for every dollar you spent the store, what does a farmer get? And after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented his farm bill reforms, you had more than 50 cents on the dollar going back to the farmer. But now, you know, after this massive consolidation of power, farmers get the lowest ever recorded in American history. It's like 13 cents. So just imagine for a moment what that would mean for rural America if it was 50 cents to 13 cents of their, you know, what they sold and came back to them, what you buy at the store goes back to them. How much that would just change this country. So like that to me is like, that's just the bigger picture here. It's a system's just not working for most people, except for a few that are benefiting at our expense.
So just to kind of to wrap up your summary there, like the average consumer is paying more for less quality food, and the average farmer is going to be seeing less money at the end of the year. And as inputs rise again and again, it seems like there's consolidation in the stuff that you're making and selling as a farmer. There's consolidation, and also the stuff that you're buying that you need to, whether it's seed or chemical or equipment or animals, it seems like there's less and less sellers of those. So you're getting squeezed on both ends, and that is a direct cause of, that is a direct result from this consolidation in the agricultural space.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that is exactly what's going on here.
So this is a question that you'll often get from those who are either in that agricultural space begrudgingly, or maybe they are actually big fans of growing corn and soy or having large-scale dairy and pig operations, defending the system, saying, you know, we have to have this. There's too many people. We need to feed the world. So is there a system that has large-scale industrial operations but they don't act as barons? Is there a system that is created where that works, or is it just inherently not going to work?
Well, let me start with the premise. I don't trust anyone that says feed the world and likes ethanol in the same. Because you're taking the best farmland in the world and you're wasting it in your car, and you're making prices go higher, and you're causing people to starve. Like, let's just be very clear on that point.
Do you happen to have, I've often wondered, I've heard a lot of different numbers being thrown out, but do you happen to know the percentage of corn that gets grown for ethanol use, for not foodstuffs whatsoever, just goes directly into ethanol production?
Yeah, so USDA actually publishes these figures, and about 2 years ago, for the first time ever, ethanol became the largest use of corn. I don't think it's 50%. I think it dances around 48%. You know, I think low 40s is used for industrial animal feed, and then a small chunk is used for like corn syrup and stuff. But it's around there.
So with those numbers, and you could extrapolate you could extrapolate that 48% of the acreage used for corn is not used for growing food. I mean, that's not a far stretch to assume.
I will say what people will respond, you know, big ag people will respond to that point is, well, you can use some of the grain left over when you process ethanol for like confinement feed, but you're only using a portion of it. And let me reiterate, you're using fossil fuels to grow this feed for corn, which at its best is a wash for the climate. Ethanol at its best. Like, it's not good for the climate. Like, let's just be very frank on that. There's no conversation to be had there. So you can get some of it back, but it still doesn't justify not growing produce. The other thing to your point, though, to your question, is I think what I really come home back to is I kind of view a lot of this as Goldilocks. Like, you know, there is efficiencies from being bigger, and every market's different. Like, but at some point, too, it does cross a line. Things get too concentrated, and they corrupt the political system. And I think that's just the point where we're at. How do we get back to that sweet spot, that Goldilocks? You know, there's a lot of big meat companies, but a lot of them aren't employing child labor. You know, but there's a certain few that are, and they keep pushing the envelope. And I think the bigger thing of this moment is you're just not seeing the accountability that should happen. People should be punished for breaking laws, and they're not.
That we'll talk a little bit more later about this, but when we talked about JBS, that's the Brazilian meat packer. There's some you brought up, you know, slaps on the wrist with for those guys when it'd be the equivalent of fining me 10 cents for a parking ticket. I'm going to park in that same spot every day for the rest of my life then, because it doesn't mean anything to me.
I'm glad you said that phrase, Joe, slap on the wrist, because so every chapter is kind of built around an idea. And when I was researching JBS, I view myself as like meat's kind of what I know. It's my forte. And I was even shocked at how often they've engaged in very questionable business practices. I'm going to be very careful with my words here because this one's very litigious. But when I was researching, writing that chapter, I just kept being like, oh, this is like a child that has never been punished by a parent. So they keep pushing the envelope. And like, that's why I kept thinking of slap the wrist. You know what I mean? At some point, like the kids does something bad and they don't face consequences, they're going to do it worse. And that's what JBS is. And so I kept, if you notice in that chapter, I use that phrase slap the wrist a lot because I wanted that to be the key idea you took away from that chapter is this is what happens when companies do not face consequences is it gets worse.
So you had talked a little bit earlier about enforcement not being there. And this kind of leads into my next question, because I think there's got to be a two-pronged attack. There's got to be the policy put in place that allows for the enforcement, but we also need to have the enforcement there. So this next question, it will be a little bit of a two-parter. So what specific, and I know policy is very, very long-winded and can be confusing on purpose sometimes, but is there a specific policy where you could go, if we just crossed this one out or changed this a little bit, we could do away with a large majority of how this operation is going so far?
Like how to fix these like markets, or what do you mean
like,
by that?
So I guess is there one certain thing that like policy that was put in that really opened the doors, where like is there one loophole that is used again and again and again by these companies? Or is it really just the enforcement is not there, like the policies are in place and the enforcement is not there?
Gotcha. So you're asking what's the original sin?
Essentially,
I would
yes.
say the big is the collapse of antitrust enforcement in America in the early 1980s, I think really ushered in this. President Reagan basically stopped enforcing our anti-monopoly laws, which allowed a lot of these companies, it's not organic growth. Like JBS did not sell an ounce of meat in America, you know, 20 years ago. They entered, I believe, in America in 2005. And it wasn't like they sold a really good product and they got a lot of market share. It's just instead they bribed politicians to get a lot of cheap money to buy a ton of companies. One of my most powerful slides I show people is I show them 8 different slides, and on each slide are about 12 different meat brands a company owns. So you could be buying their meat and just not know. And that would not have been possible if it wasn't for the Reagan administration basically ignoring that framework that really was to me the hallmark of America for a century, that really kept markets competitive. And I mean, like McCoffee Baron, a lot of the barons in my book is just they became barons because they were able to buy companies that they could not have bought just a few decades ago.
So essentially these, like the toothless antitrust enforcement was, these people did the thing that the policy says is wrong, and they never had anyone come in and say, you know what, we cannot do that. We're actually going to stop this merger, or we're going to break up this company.
Bingo. And I will say, though, what kind of contradicts this point is my last baron is Walmart. and they're the king of kings. And they didn't really buy a lot of companies. I mean, Sam Walton got his market share 1 in 3 groceries through, you know, just organic growth. But I will say there was a whole other statute of regulations that were ignored under the Reagan called Roberts and Patman Act. They basically put up guardrails between wholesalers and companies like Walmart, and that basically collapsed, so allowed Walmart to get a lot of market power to squeeze suppliers. But Walmart, to its credit, did not become a robber baron or a giant through acquisitions. It did it through organic growth. So every market's unique, and I always want to be careful too of having a silver bullet answer or silver bullet reason. Is it usually just it's a confluence of things working together to reinforce things to either break markets or to make them better.
And I feel that's why it's so hard to do, or maybe we think it's hard to do, because it's not like if I push this domino down, the next one goes. It's like they kind of all the dominoes need to fall at the same time, because one relies on the other. And you can't just say, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this and change this policy or start enforcing this, when you don't have everything lined up. So it's really the lining all that stuff up, getting the right people in place, and getting the right judges on the Supreme Court that will uphold decisions. And so it's really got to be a perfect storm before you can really bring the gavel down and break these sort of things up.
True, but that's life. I mean, these stuff are complicated. I mean, even when we dealt with these meat companies a century ago, it wasn't one thing that, you know, broke up the meat trust. It was truly a combination of things. And it's, I don't mean that, but that's also why I want to harken back to that last Gilded Ages. That last Gilded Age produced a reform movement, because people were sick of it. They worked locally to then usher in the reform era. And I think we're on the cusp of that, and it won't be easy. I mean, concentrated interests never give you a seat at the table. You have to fight for it. Mm-hmm. But we've been here before. We do.
So, I got to take a second here just for some station identification. My name is Joseph Childs. You're listening to the Crawford Stewardship Project radio show on WDRT 91.9 FM, radio from the Driftless area of Wisconsin. You can also find lots of other awesome episodes of radio shows and podcasts online at WDRT.org. You can look for this one underneath the radio show archives. We're sitting down with Austin Frerich, author of Barons. We're talking about how the food system in the United States is so concentrated, and how that affects the average consumer, the average American, because everyone's got to eat, and the average farmer, and if this is a good thing or a bad thing. And so far, we're learning about all the ways that it's happened, what was put in place to allow these barons to exist and thrive, really, and how, if any, there are policies that can break those up. So we talked a little bit about, it's very complicated. If it wasn't complicated, I'm sure we would have done this by now. But is there a way for, I want to go back to the last question, is there a way for these people to exist? There's going to be large and small companies in no matter what industry. There's always going to be that. But is there a way for those companies to exist without it being a monopolistic market?
Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing. To me, you enforce a lot of basic regulations. A lot of these barons their empires are no longer economically viable. Like, I just think of my hog baron in particular. You treat hog manure like human manure. You know what I mean? It's no longer economical to shove a bunch of pigs into a metal shed. There's like a lot of things like that where, you know, but I don't want to think of should they exist or not. That's not the question. To me, the question is, what should these systems look like? What kind of food system do we want to have on our table? And then kind of let the outcomes be what they be.
And I'm glad you brought up food systems as how you worded it. And to me, that is something that is lost upon the rhetoric that is spewed now, is there's one food system, there's a global food system. That's what people refer to. We're a globalized economy, we're a globalized society. But for me, my food system should not include Brazil or Venezuela or Mexico or even California or Texas. My food system should be much more local than that, and there should be just a massive amount of those food systems, not just one system. So I think just changing the expectation of where you get your food from, and maybe you shouldn't be able to get an orange in January in Wisconsin at any time that you want. Maybe, you know, those seasonal foods and eating locally should be something that we do more often.
Then, like, I would add, there's beauty in diversity. And what I mean by that is, like, one of my favorite things about Wisconsin are the supper clubs. I literally just bought this incredible book series on the supper clubs in Wisconsin, and I love that. Anytime I'm in the state, I try a new one that people recommend to me. And what a cool cultural thing that you don't see elsewhere. And at the same time, too, the beauty of America is we have a place like New Orleans. Like, I mean, who doesn't love red beans and rice? New Orleans is, it's a creature of its own. It's its own food system. How do we have those thrive? How do we, because local food is, that's what makes a place a place, is they maintain culture, those local restaurants, those local farmers. And I think so much of this moment now is everything just feels the same vanilla blah. That's what a corporate entity wants. They want to serve you the same industrial pork chop in Maine as you get in New Mexico, but neither one has flavor to them. But I want to get back to that system where we help those local systems thrive, because, the difference between Iowa and Wisconsin is, Iowa has a big maize rye culture. They love their tenderloins. We love our kolaches. There's all these, little things, and they make life fun. I can't say that enough. It's pride. People feel pride in the work they do when they're maintaining those local food traditions versus, cooking some frozen thing that you got from, wherever.
Yeah, I've always loved growing up around the area and having, people, when you say you're from Wisconsin, they're like, oh, cheese curds. I'm like, yep, cheese curds. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and when I lived in Madison, I loved, people had really strong opinions on who had the best cheese curds.
Oh, that is a statewide thing for sure, and I know where they are too, and I'm not telling anybody. So we got a couple minutes left here. I wanted to not end on a gloomy note, but what are some things that the average person can do, or maybe if you're not such an average person, if you've got a little bit of entrepreneurial spirit or some gusto that you want to really help move this along, what are some things that people can do to help mitigate these robber barons, to fight against this?
Yeah, let me just start by really emphasizing the point. This always starts local in America. For example, the first anti-monopoly laws in the world came out of Iowa. It was Iowa farmers mad about grain elevators and railroads. They passed the first anti-monopoly laws. A few states did it. Then the federal government did it. And then finally, Teddy Roosevelt came along and did something. But it started locally. It started with farm organizations. And even in Wisconsin, so much of the New Deal came out of Wisconsin. It was unemployment insurance started in Wisconsin. So I say this because, D.C. is always the last one to know, but you've got to start somewhere. And so just from a local level, things people can do is, a lot of farmers will tell you they don't like doing the farmer's market. You get rained out. It's not consistent. But help pair them up with that local school or the local college so they can, every week they know they're serving carrots or some dairy to the local school. You're keeping your money locally, and it's also better, it's better tasting food. Build on that.
I just had a team breakfast this morning, and we probably talked for 15 minutes about how they didn't like the school food. And I was like, I can't wait to talk with Austin about this, because that was one of his things of, if we want to help out the local farmers and improve the local school's food, connecting people that way, and, maybe just going and starting that conversation, even if you're not a farmer, just start talking about this kind of stuff, bring it to the forefront of people's minds. If you hear this on the radio, maybe point someone in our direction and say there's an episode on food. We've got a lot more to discuss, Austin, and we're going to continue that in the last hour and a half here on the CSP podcast. But for now, I've been Joseph Childs for the Crawford Stewardship Project radio show, and I've sat down here with Austin Furick, the author of Barons, and talked quite at length about our food system and the concentration in it. We've been listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, and you can find this show online at wdrt.org. Thank you.